We are looking at chapter 14, finishing up chapter 14 and getting into 15 today in the book of Revelation. The nice thing about chapter 15 is it's really short. It's one of the shortest chapters in the book, so we can make probably a good bound there. But we are excited to keep working through this book. It's a really good book. It's chock full of Old Testament references. So if you've not been as disciplined in your Old Testament studies, that probably will show in the book of Revelation. Lots of culture here too, so a good thorough study of the first few centuries of the church would be really helpful, particularly the first 100 or 200 years of the church. Definitely really good information, the book of Revelation. Really helpful, really practical too, to the day in which we find ourselves, where being a Christian can cause added hostilities in this day and time. And they are getting worse, it seems. But we are probably going to be picking up here in chapter 14, verse 6. So be ready for that. So like I said, we're in Revelation chapter 14. Revelation chapter 14, very similar to Revelation chapter 7 as far as the imagery. This is where that 144,000 number comes from. And we talked about how numbers have a great symbolic value in the book of Revelation, particularly oftentimes completeness versus incompleteness. 144,000, 12's complete, 12's complete, and then you have 10 times 10 times 10. So it's all complete. Completeness. God's people connected to the idea of completeness. God not overlooking any of his people. God not withholding his protection from any of his people. In contrast to that, you have the number of incompleteness, which the great number of incompleteness in the book of Revelation that everybody loves is 666. We had talked about that. And you could have all sorts of monkeying with numbers. You can come up with all sorts of different names connected to that. But at the end of the day, 6 was considered to the Jews to be what? Less than complete. It fell short of complete. And so it was connected to humanity. It was connected to, you know, the idea of unlucky. And we even have a number in our society that most people consider unlucky. And what is that number? 13. So is that convention foreign to us? No, not really. Why are there 3 6s? What is 3 connected to in the scriptures? Divinity. And so you have a man or men impersonating God. And when we look at the first century, and we look at the fourth kingdom, what was characteristic of the fourth kingdom in Asia Minor? Worship of the emperor. Worship of the emperor, and so this makes a great deal of sense to be thinking about the struggles that they went through. And we may face that time where we have to do certain things to appease our government that we would otherwise not do. I think we are starting to broach that a little bit, and so we have to be considerate of that. We have to be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Azariah, Mishael, and Hananiah, who serve God first. Peter and John and the apostles, we want to be dedicated to that. But insofar as we are able within good conscience to obey our civil rulers, then we are called to that purpose as well. And so we have to tread that line, which is no doubt becoming more and more difficult. Chapter 14, verses 6 through 13 is our next section. Basically two sections here. We have this vision of the angel with the gospel, which is pretty unique because you don't typically have an angel connected to the gospel. There tends to be, the gospel tends to be connected to human messengers. And so this is a little bit different. This is a little bit unique as far as the New Testament. And then the second part of this, we have the doom that these non-believers are committed to. So can I get somebody to read chapter 14, verses 6 through 13, the book of Revelation? Tom, go ahead.
I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having everlasting gospel decreed to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. Saying with a loud voice, fear God, give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who has made heaven and earth, the sea, and springs of water. And another angel followed, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, for she has made all nations drink the wine of the wrath. himself, but also drink the one wrath of God. And he poured out full strength in the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels, in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here's the patience of the saints. There are those who keep the commandments of God and faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, "Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord." Now, yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. And I looked and behold a white cloud.
That's good, Tom. Thank you. Thank you. So we will cut it off there at verse 13. But we had talked previously about how Revelation is chock full of angels. And that is one of the things that really sets it apart from the rest of the Bible. You don't hear a whole lot of references to angels. You do have some, but they do come somewhat sporadically. When you look at the book of Revelation, angels are popping up over and over again. And why might this be in the case of Revelation? Sorry? Yes, it is elevating above our domain, above our region, and looking at things from the eternal perspective, looking at things from the heavenly perspective, from the cosmic perspective. And so we are elevating beyond these things, and for that reason, it is a little bit different than the rest of the New Testament, certainly complementary to the New Testament and the Old Testament as well, but different in that regard. So we have this another angel that comes up in verse 6. For our purposes in this section, we're going to call this the first angel. The first angel in this section. That's verses 6 and 7. It may be hard to kind of follow that, so we're going to try and break that down, make it a little bit easier. The first angel represents the preaching of the eternal gospel to those on the earth, encouraging them to worship God and not Caesar. Urging change because judgment is at hand. The time really is coming where there's no turning back. And so this really is the message of the first angel. This is complemented by the message of the second angel in this section in verse 8. The second angel announces the fall of Babylon. And Babylon in the book of Revelation is a symbolic name given to Rome, which is the current agency of Satan. And this idea of fallen is Babylon the Great really comes from the Old Testament. We had alluded to that in Revelation 11, verse 8, but Isaiah forecast that beforehand, and then Jeremiah, of course, is talking about that when Jerusalem is falling. He's going to say after 70 years, Babylon will fall. By the way, what kingdom takes over after Babylon? The Medes and the Persians, they're namely led by what great leader of the Medes and the Persians? Before him?
Cyrus.
Cyrus. Cyrus. Darius, there's a little bit of... Maybe, could be Cyrus. Maybe not. So we are dealing with Medes and the Persians taking over after them. Again, recycling Old Testament language. If you want to understand this correctly, make sure you understand it correctly in the Old Testament first. So, Babylon, a physical nation, fell. In the book of Revelation, what's the message? If it's consistent with how the Old Testament uses it, a physical nation is falling. But the fall of Rome points to what greater loss? Or whose greater loss? Satan's greater loss, because Rome has become an agent of Satan. It's stated as though it's already happened, although in the book we haven't necessarily seen the complete downfall of Rome yet. We have seen some temporal judgments, but it's not completely fallen yet. Chapter 17 through 19 is going to talk about that in more detail. But when God decrees that something is going to happen before it happens, it is as if it has already happened, because God knows the end from the beginning, and when he says that something is going to fall, it will fall. The third angel here, for our purposes, verses 9 through 11, participants in imperial cult worship will be judged. Those who went into the marketplace and they offered their pinch of incense, whether they were crossing their fingers behind their back or not, they will fall just as much as those who openly worshiped the emperor. Jim McQuiggan said, "Dreadful sentence, filled with the woes of a million eternities, filled with the echoes of hopelessness, filled with the blackness of forever." I like that. I think he did that very well. You may have noticed, by the way, just going back to verse 8 very quickly, if you have, Tom, you read from New King James, right? Okay, so when Tom was reading at the end of verse 8, it mentioned the wrath of her immorality. Does anybody have anything different in verse 8? Fornication? Well, yeah, that would be a little bit earlier, because immorality is going to be fornication.
So
verse 8, yes. Passion. Okay, passion. So we've got passion, we've got, it could be wrath, the immorality can be fornication. Believe the word that's used there. Porneia. That typically is connected to sexual immorality. But the difference between passion or wrath, if you have that in your translation, is that the word that's used here is the word for to burn. To burn. And it's thumo. We talked about that a little bit on Wednesday. It's the idea of burning. And so that can be passion, that I burn for somebody who is the object of my passion. It could be the idea of wrath. I am burning up because of my anger. And so that's one of those places where you're going to have a little bit of a difference in translation. But that's why, because the word is a little bit ambiguous. So this would be contrasted with those who abstain. Remember Lazarus and the rich man in Luke 16? The rich man in this life had every pleasure he could lay his hands on. Lazarus sat at the gate with open sores and dogs licking those sores. And that completely flips on the other side of eternity. And that's really what we're talking about here. Those who are being put to death for their faith, burned at the stake, used as nightlights for Nero parties, used to incense and inflame Domitian's egocentrism and egomania, they are actually the ones who are going to be exalted. Remember what Jesus said, if you're humbled, you will be exalted, but if you exalt yourself like the Roman imperial cult and those who are following it, you will be humbled. You will be broken down and shown for who you really are. This idea in verses 9 through 11, mixed in full strength in verse 10, mixed in full strength. Back in the day, they would dilute their wine with 2 to 3 parts water. And he says, nope. We are completely giving it undiluted, and you are going to be reeling, is the idea. You are going to be reeling with the judgment that you are going to face. Nothing has mingled the wrath of God. Nothing has broken the wrath of God or lessened the wrath of God. He is going to pour out his full wrath and indignation on you. And again, this is an Old Testament image that comes up over and over again. The idea of the undiluted wrath, or the cup of God's wrath, comes up in the poetic literature of the Old Testament, comes up in the prophetic literature of the Old Testament. Jeremiah 25, particularly there, Jerusalem, and then, of course, Babylon, going to experience that. Robert Harkwright in the Truth Commentary said, faithful saints had suffered public derision, and now their oppressors will experience shame before a more august assembly of spectators. They are going to be shown from a heavenly perspective their true colors. When Christians are suffering, it's easy to think that God has abandoned. It's easy for Christians to think that God has abandoned them, let alone those who are outside of Christianity. You think about the Old Testament. Oftentimes we'll talk about Israel. When Israel fell, they would say, where is your God? You remember when Assyria invaded them? And they said, where is your God? You know, Rabshakeh and some of these others came in to Hezekiah, to Judah even, and said, where is your God? You know, we're whipping up on you guys. Where is your God? And the world does that. But there will come a time before a more august assembly of spectators where our dedication will be shown to be victorious. Our faithfulness will allow us to overcome, whereas those who gave in to the power of the world will be shown to have desperate and trying loss. Now, continuing on here, we've got this imagery of fire and brimstone. Think of fire and brimstone, you probably don't think of really anything else but hell. If you were to think about an Old Testament background for this, who gets fire and brimstone piled up on them? Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plains. But in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, it says that God will come with his mighty angels. Jesus will come with his mighty angels, dealing out retribution to those who do not know God, those who do not acknowledge him or obey him. And he will pour off his eternal wrath upon them. And this does come up again in the Old Testament prophets. Verse 12 says, here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. Remember the seven letters to the seven churches of Asia Minor? What do you say over and over again by the end of the letter? You have to endure. You have to persevere. You have to overcome. And then he talked about how he would give them victory. So patience really is the key here, not only in circumstances, but also in dealing with those who hate us. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor, love yourself, love your friend, but hate your enemies. But I say to you, Jesus said, love your enemies. Pray for those who despitefully use you and even rail against you. So we have to think about what we are committed to as far as our patience, allowing that patience to grow in us and to develop us and strengthen us. A call for them to be faithful and endure, and a promise for them to wait for God to act. We had seen that with the seals. Do you remember the martyrs crying out, God, when are you going to act? When are you going to avenge us? We've seen that a few times in the book of Revelation, and God assures them that he is going to defend them and protect them and vindicate them. Verse 13, where do you usually hear verse 13 quoted? Funerals. That was an easy one. You got it, Debbie. You got it. You usually hear this at funerals. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. You think about Revelation 20 a little bit later on, there is this picture of the Lamb's Book of Life. And God's people are vindicated and given rest because of that. Psalm 116, verse 15, precious in the sight of God is what? His godly ones, yes. Precious in the sight of God is the death of his godly ones, of his saints. How could that be precious in God's sight? Because it doesn't seem precious, does it? How can it be precious in God's sight? They've remained faithful. They finished the fight. That's exactly what Paul talks about too. Remember, how does Paul's life end traditionally? He's beheaded. James, the apostle, what happens to him in Acts chapter 12? He's killed too. Stephen, killed. Antipas, in the book of Revelation chapter 2, roasted to death. Bartholomew, that's a little trickier. Church history, how does he traditionally die? He is filleted alive. Was that precious in God's sight?
Not the method, but at least
Not the method, but the outcome, certainly. So when we experience hardship, even to the point of the death of our loved ones, even to our own gruesome death, what helps us to see things as God sees them? The fact that they had remained faithful, the call for us to remain faithful. You look at some of the examples of history, and they may be glamorized a little bit, but a lot of these individuals, when they're burned at the stake, they're crying out for God to open the eyes of the King of England. They're crying out, they're singing hymns when they're being burned. That may be glamorized a little bit, but even in the case of those who were hostile towards Christianity that were present for that, when they write about these sorts of things, they give testimony to that. So it may be glamorized by believers, but it's probably not glamorized by non-believers. We have to see things as God sees them. Beyond the earthly life is the bright morning of eternity. That is what we must hold on to. I want to take a second here to talk about the reality of hell. Because in our day and time, there are many believers who are trying to deny the existence of hell, saying that, the Bible doesn't really talk about that. When he uses that language, it's more of just a cessation of existence. You just kind of stop. And besides the practical issues with that, any concept of justice, any concept of eternal justice is completely thrown out the window. There is what the Bible describes. Religious materialists, this is Hark Rider in the Truth Commentary, religious materialists such as Jehovah's Witnesses and Seventh-day Adventists speak of hell as only the grave. They deny that the divine punishment is endless. In fact, the Bible speaks of the eternal judgment of God against sin as worse than death. If all that occurs at death is total cessation of consciousness, how could the rejection of Christ bring sorer punishment than being stoned to death? Jesus spoke many times of the wicked being cast into a place of torment where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Those who attempt to minimize these horrible descriptions of eternal punishment usually ask, how could a loving God cast anyone into a lake of fire and brimstone? But this approach plays on man's emotion and reasoning that is based on his own shallow experience before anyone dares to redefine the consequences of God's wrath. He should explain why a God of love would allow his only begotten son to die on the cruel cross of Calvary. Man is not in a position to assess the heinous nature of sin, nor to determine what might be its just punishment. I like that. I think that was a good thing to bring up at this point, based on how people typically use this section. All right, any comments on verses 6 through 13? John Cullinane.
What you all wrote here just reminds me of the importance of not blaming someone else. Taking responsibility not only for your actions now, but the consequences of your actions. Whether you're alive here on earth and you're dealing with those, or upon death. You're right when you say the world is not willing to acknowledge that. And they'll even step further away from God if you were to turn around and tell them, well, your son or daughter is living in sin, and they're not willing to have that. They would pull even further away.
Yeah.
They don't want to accept that reality.
Whether we accept it or not, that is the reality, right? We can deny it all we want. Andrew.
This is one of the greatest resources. Perception that Satan has in his arsenal that he drives people further and further away, just deluding them, hey, you don't have to worry about what happens. It's almost the same, might as well do whatever you want. It gives that permission to engage in whatever types of behavior.
Yeah. So let's use a little bit of a gruesome example. Let's talk about a mass murderer. A mass murderer who gets away with it. Nobody ever catches him. If you were to deny the existence of hell, then that mass murderer never receives any justice at all. You see, it's easy to deny hell when you think, hey, I'm a decent person. But if you were to ask the parents of a child who was murdered by this mass murderer how they felt, you're going to feel a little differently. When we are acted against, sometimes that can open up our eyes to the reality of justice. And that's the thing about pain. Pain can be God's megaphone. Pain can open us up to the reality of this broken and cruel world and long for something better. Let's take a look at verses 14 through 20. Finish up chapter 14, 14 through 20. Who wants to read that for us? Andrew, go ahead.
Now look, and behold, a white cloud sitting on a cloud was one like the Son of Man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. Then he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth was reaped. Another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, and he also had a sharp sickle. And another angel, the one who had power over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle and gather clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. The winepress was trod outside the city, and blood came out from the winepress up to the horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles.
That's pretty graphic. That is pretty graphic. That's about as graphic as you can get. But here we have two very contrasting harvests. Who is being described in verse 14?
Jesus.
How do you know that?
One like the Son of Man having his head the golden crown.
Yep. So how is it that we have an angel in verse 15 telling Jesus what to do? John Cullinane. Andrew?
Well, it appears that it's coming directly from God the Father, and only God knows when the time is, referring back to when Christ said, even the Son doesn't know.
Yeah, I think it's too much when we read this as like a command, like in the sense that this angel is commanding Jesus. I think this angel is a messenger from the throne of God, because that's where he comes from in verse 15. He is conveying this message. He's not commanding Jesus as being an authority over him. Robin. Good thought. I think very clearly here, verse 14 is Jesus. I mean, it's hard to get around that. Some people try to argue that this is just another angel, but it's not specified as an angel. And this whole section is filled with another angel, another angel, another angel. And then it breaks from that. Says one like a Son of Man, one with a golden crown on his head. And you probably will notice in your version of the Bible that the pronoun in verse 14 is capitalized. I think most translators recognize this as being in reference to Jesus. But Jesus is going to perform a harvest of the righteous. And this is very much a wheat harvest sort of image. Go ahead.
Seems like they're borrowing on the same imagery to me. You see, they're close and they're working together. Certainly, an angel would hold no authority over Jesus, but they were his emissaries.
That's right.
Very close.
Very good thought. And one thing I do want to mention, too, in connection to this, is that the word angel can just mean messenger. It doesn't necessarily have to be a celestial being, even in some cases. I think here it is in this section. But in some cases, you just have a person who serves as an angel. A person serves as a messenger. Now, that doesn't mean that people die and they become angels and they get their wings. That's a very different viewpoint. But sometimes the word is just used in a general sense of messenger. But in the book of Revelation, particularly, we're dealing with a lot of celestial language. And so that makes us elevate our eyes. Thank you, Louis, for that comment. So we have this wheat harvest imagery by Jesus. Why might Jesus be the one to reap his people? As opposed to an angel, because we have an angel here who's going to reap the unrighteous. We have Jesus being the one who steps in for the righteous. Andrew. His sheep, right? Robin? Go ahead, Lisa. That'd be a good thought, too, yeah. Robin? He purchased them. Who are these first century Christians, and who are we called to imitate? Jesus. Just in our lifestyle? No. No, in some ways, we compensate for whatever might be deficient in the sacrifice of Jesus, as the New Testament writers write. I don't think in the sense that Jesus is deficient necessarily, but that is the language that's used there. It's the idea that we could build on the sacrifice of Jesus is probably the best way to convey that. Lisa and Robin, you guys are right in my line of vision. You both have the same colored shirt on. That's trippy. And then what comes after this is this grape harvest. You know, the wine of our immorality, as we saw earlier in the chapter, and now the grape wine press. So there is a difference in the imagery. God's people are depicted as being like dry wheat ready for the harvest. Remember what Jesus said? The harvest is ripe. The harvest is ready. Pray to the Lord of the harvest that he might send extra workers. God's people being depicted, or those who would be open to the gospel at least, are depicted as being like dry wheat. And then those who are antithetical to the vision of God are displayed as being like grapes. So the wheat, dry and ready, a fitting metaphor for the Christians being martyred. The grapes. Now, grapes that are plump and juicy on the vine, they have an outward appearance of being good. But they are going to go into the wine press, and what happens in the wine press? They are crushed. They are crushed. So while they look alluring, while they look plump, while they look decadent, they are going to be destroyed. In this section, definitely the idea is the harvest is ripe. The harvest is ripe. Here's a picture of an ancient sickle that would be kind of helpful for you to think about if you've not been on the farm, at least for a while. Three more angels here further describe Rome's downfall. So that makes six angels and Jesus in this passage. So for a total of seven celestial beings. The Lord of the harvest, remember that's how Jesus is displayed. The Lord of the harvest with a sharp sickle punishes the rebellious, vindicating the obedient. We talked about Jesus recently in a sermon from Psalm 2. He has a rod of iron, and all people are to kiss him. And those who do not will be dealt with a rod of iron. Even if the kings of the earth ally themselves against Jesus, they will be destroyed. So with a sharp sickle, he punishes the rebellious, vindicating the obedient. Then we deal with the fourth angel in verses 14 through 16, judgment as a wheat harvest. Why is this angel instructing Jesus in verse 15? We talked about that a little bit. Angels simply conveying the will of the Father, and God is the one who will gather the faithful. The suffering of those who persist in rejecting God's love are self-imposed and self-perpetuated. That's the difficulty with trying to get somebody to realize the depths to which they sink in sin. It is self-perpetuated and self-imposed. It's hard to get somebody to acknowledge that. Louis? So this fifth angel that comes up in verse 17, he has a sickle and he comes from the throne of God. The idea of angels coming from the throne of God, we've seen that repeatedly in the book, and we will see it more. Then you have the sixth angel from the altar, probably the one with the power over fire, as we saw earlier in chapter 8. Isaiah 6, Isaiah says, "Woe is me, I'm undone, man of unclean lips." And what does the angel do? Takes a coal from the altar and fixes that problem. So we have this angel instructing the previous angel to harvest the grapes. Everyone who is drunk of Babylon's wine is going to find destruction as well. That's a reference to earlier in verse 8. Drinking of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and they are going to be crushed in God's wine press. This is a graphic and gory depiction of widespread death and destruction. There is blood up to the horse's bridle and roughly 180 miles of it. There's not enough blood on the planet to make that much blood. This is actually from the book of Enoch. First Enoch uses this image too, and First Enoch would be from the Intertestament, so it would have been written before Revelation. So John is using a description that was written before to depict this. And that's okay. You know, the biblical writers can use other people's descriptions. He's not taking from the Old Testament as much here as he's maybe borrowing that and taking Old Testament language and tying it into it. This trampling will occur outside of the city, and that is specified probably to indicate the idea of being away from the fellowship of God. They're outside of God's city, is the idea there. Jesus was crucified outside of the city. Does that mean he was outside of God's fellowship? No, it's different there. It's a different intention. There he's been separated from the city of the world, the city of wickedness that Jerusalem had become at that point. Any questions or thoughts on chapter 14 as we wrap things up here? Andrew?
I don't know if this is something that is there any connection whatsoever about the grapes and the vine that is maybe mocking or
in what sense?
Well, just mocking because I think that it would be any imagery of they just fast and then drink the royal cup drink and here they're symbolically, ironically pressed by something that would be considered a royal drink.
Yeah, maybe so. All right, let's introduce chapter 15 here. So we've seen a series of three sevens in the book of Revelation. Well, we're in the third series anyways. There are three series of seven in the book of Revelation. It's a little bit small for you, but if you want a copy of this, then I'll make sure that you have that, and it will be online as well. We've got the seven seals. Those are opened by the Lamb. We've got the seven trumpets. Those are blown by seven angels. And then we have seven bowls, which are poured by seven angels. And it's interesting to compare them. A lot of them do follow a very similar sort of effect. When one thing is done, it affects a sphere that is affected by the corresponding later image. And then you do have sort of a double interlude, as we talked about with the seven seals, the seven trumpets. You don't have an interlude of the seven bowls because it's it. There's no more delay. And there is this final destruction idea that's happening here. So, interesting. R.C. Lenski said, the seven seals reveal, the seven trumpets announce and warn, and the seven bowls execute. So if you want just kind of an easier way of thinking about Revelation as a whole, God makes his revelation known, his revelation announces and warns, and then he executes punishment on the evildoer. That's a nice, easy way of looking at the book of Revelation. If you get a little lost with the seven seals and the seven trumpets and the seven bowls of wrath, that's maybe an easier way of thinking about it. Yep. That it is interesting that there is this particular seven that comes up three times, and the intentionality in the book of Revelation probably would suggest that. Yeah. Set up for the next section of Revelation. The opening of the seventh seal led to the seven trumpets. The blowing of the seventh trumpet leads to the pouring out of the seven bowls of wrath. Bruce Metzger, the writer of the book of Revelation, has carefully laid out a series of parallel and yet ever-progressing panels. These display God's plan from different vantage points, stressing one or another feature. At the same time, the different accounts reinforce one another and bring before the reader over and over again the truth that God rules and overrules in the affairs of humankind. The stage of Revelation concerns how God is just and righteous in judging the wicked so thoroughly. In this theodicy or defense of God's goodness, all the participants in the judgment of God are revealed in the rest of the book. God's wrath will be poured out in 15 and 16. Destruction of Babylon is described in 17 and 18. Christ's victory is proclaimed in chapters 19 through 20. And then judgment and the beauty of the new heavens and the new earth are laid out in 20 through 22. And we will pick up there next week, Lord willing, and wrap up chapter 15. I would encourage you to look at chapter 15. It won't take you very long to look at chapter 15, so spend a little bit of time looking at your center column reference, looking at some of the background for the Old Testament language. And looking at maybe, if you get a chance, some different thoughts on the chapter. We'll plan on covering all of chapter 15 and then get through verse 7 of chapter 16 next week, Lord willing. Thank you for the class, everyone.